This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so let's start with our week in review, beginning with the opioid addiction crisis, which kills approximately 4 people every day in Massachusetts.
That's the bad news, of course. The hopeful news, perhaps, is that just about everybody is paying attention to it now, from the Attorney General to the Governor to Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who was in Boston yesterday.
This, in many ways, the heroin epidemic is a prescription drug created epidemic.
Well, this week, state lawmakers also debated legislation to address the crisis, and a new addiction treatment law took effect. But will it be enough?
Joining us now to explore that question and the rest of the week's news is Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hi, Shira. Good to have you back.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to see you as always.
It's good to be with you.
So we heard Hillary Clinton there, who attended a meeting yesterday on addiction. Her idea that this is first and foremost a prescription drug crisis is right in line with what Governor Charlie Baker has been saying. Here's the governor.
This idea that you write prescriptions for 30 or 60 days or give somebody 50, 60, 70, 80 Percocets for something that's an acute incident just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Baker says he'd support legislation to cut back on overprescribing of pain medication. Measures would include requiring the Department of Public Health to notify doctors of their own prescribing practices. So, Jim, I'll start with you. And obviously, this crisis is going to require many measures, but is focusing on this, trying to limit what doctors can prescribe, the amount of pain pills that they can prescribe, is that the place to start here?
Well, I don't think it's a place that we've started. I think there's already been a law that Governor Patrick got passed in August 2014, which does some good things in terms of making sure that people can get treatment without having to get pre-authorized, and that process can be pretty onerous. But, of course, that doesn't solve the problem fully either, right? So I do think at this point it's a good time to move towards prescription drugs, how you not only prescribe them, what prescribing practices are, but also how do you dispose of them? There's just a lot of different facets of this when you have an illness in your family or someone who's taking this stuff. I mean, the access to these kinds of drugs in just your own cabinet, there's lots of evidence that's the majority of how kids who start using these things actually get hooked on them.
Yeah, right. Shira, what's your view on all this attention this week on this problem? What are you taking away from it?
Well, I do like the emphasis on monitoring prescriptions, because I'll speak as someone who covers sports. What we're seeing and hearing about a lot now are high school and college athletes who become addicted to prescription painkillers, and that addiction turns into a heroin addiction down the line. So you have kids who are injured, they're prescribed Percocet, and then they push, because these are high-achieving kids, to get back in the lineup. Mm-hmm. They get injured again, and then they develop that addiction.
Right.
I also think that a key part of this, when you're talking about how you're going to monitor prescriptions, is awareness. I think that parents of, let's say, just children in this instance, need to be made aware that there are non-opioid options for painkillers that they can give young athletes. And I think Hillary Clinton said this yesterday, which there is no reason that children should be prescribed opioid painkillers. There are options out there, and that needs to be part of the solution to this problem.
Well, Jim, you mentioned that yesterday that a state law went into effect. Among other things, it would require insurance company to cover counseling for addiction for 14 days. That's an increase, I think, of 5 or 6 days. We spoke with Ray Tomasi. He's the CEO of Gosnold on Cape Cod, an addiction treatment center. He said this is a good idea, but he wishes that it had come sooner. Here's what he said.
Dependence is certainly a crisis now, but this is a crisis that's in its 15th year. And we're very pleased on the provider side that it's getting this attention. It's unfortunately, tragedy has brought attention, and we'd have wished it had been another way.
So, I want to ask you, Jim, actually both of you, it really does seem that everyone is paying attention to this now. Presidential candidates, the governor, state lawmaker, everybody is talking about the crisis. Do you think all this attention is translating into enough of the right kind of action? What do you think?
Well, enough means you solve the problem.
Yeah.
I don't think that's actually going to be the case. We're not going to ever solve this problem fully, right? I would say, Shira was talking about awareness. One of the other groups constituent groups you really want to make sure have awareness of these are incoming doctors. So even going to the medical schools is going to be really important. It's raising awareness among doctors that what they've been doing for so long may not be the right thing, right? It's frankly raising awareness among pharmaceutical companies that we do need more options, right? So I would say this. Look, each time you take a step forward, there are a couple steps back. So when you think about the new law that just went into effect, you have to think about, you know, the impacts on the supply of beds that we actually have access to and all the rest. So this is a moving target. Each time you do something, you have to keep kind of looking at how you hone it and refine it. I think all we can do at this point is continue to focus on it. And I don't think, frankly, it's going to let up in the near term. So we're going to have plenty of reason to want to continue to focus on it.
Sure.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. And you actually bring up a very good point about the availability of beds. I think one of the facts that's coming out and all the attention that's been paid to this crisis is the fact that oftentimes the overdoses happen within very short time period of heroin addicts or reformed heroin addicts leaving rehab. And, you know, one, again, not to go, well, go back to the sports examples, but there are two parents who have been very active out of Ohio. Their son went to rehab. He was a quarterback for an Ohio college. He went to rehab, and within 12 hours of getting out of rehab, he overdosed on heroin. So I think there, you know, you have that mandatory now or the paid for 14-day stay, but it's also what happens after those 14 days.
Well, let's move on, if we can, to talk about the state's child welfare agency, the ever-embattled Department of Children and Families. This week, Governor Charlie Baker and his administration announced some sweeping changes at DCF. The key thing, says the governor, a laser-like focus on mission.
DCF's fundamental purpose is to keep kids safe. Let me repeat that. The work that will be done from this point forward will focus on one major objective, to keep kids safe.
And then the governor did release a plan in which to attempt to do that. But Jim, let's start with you. Do you think the governor's plan will fix what he's been calling mission confusion at DCF?
Well, I think it's an important recognition. I'd start by saying, look, we are near the bottom of the barrel in terms of preventing maltreatment of those kids who are in foster care and custody of the state. So we should all recognize that. So we can't do worse. And I think the recognition that you have to keep kids safe, even if it means that you are perhaps sacrificing the unitary, the unit of the family, I think is the right way forward. There has been movement forward. Even Governor Patrick had done some things in terms of new hires. There's lots of stuff moving along. But I think focusing on child safety is extremely important. I would say there's one other thing that is extremely important. If you noticed at the press conference, the governor was standing next to the head of the union.
Right.
That's very unlike the MBTA, by the way. And it's really, it's a wonderful thing to see. And I think some of it says something about Baker's background, where he was Health and Human Services Secretary before. There are relationships of trust there to some degree. And I think that the fact they're working together is important. One final quick point. We should really look at the two-tier tracking system that we've had in place since 2009, which was in part caused by this mission confusion, where there was a higher sort of there's a higher level of focus on certain cases and a moderate to lower focus on others. Most of the cases where we've seen maltreatment or even death have been in that lower or moderate category. I'm not saying you get rid of it altogether, but a lot of work has to be done there.
Right. You know, Jimmy, bring up an interesting point, and sure, I'd love to hear you follow up on this, because we talked to the union head the same afternoon that the announcement came out, and he said, yes, I mean, they were involved in some of the decision-making around this new plan, and that morale amongst the social workers at DCF has been so very low, and they hope to turn a corner here. So really quite unusual cooperation, as Jim pointed out. But still, I mean, the problems at DCF seem to run so very deep. I mean, the thing that I asked the union head was, this is a lot of low-hanging fruit. Okay, it's a place to start, but, you know, again, we keep coming to this question about big issues in Massachusetts. Is it enough?
But yeah, you mentioned low-hanging fruit. The thing that sticks out at me, you know, you have the case that made, you know, the report yesterday about the 2-year-old foster child who died of heat stroke, and then you have the 7-year-old boy from Hardwick who's currently in a coma. And although those are very different cases, the similarities are that just the lack of follow-up, the lack of communication. I know that with the Hardwick boy, they visited something like 100 times over a 6-month period. but still not one caseworker wasn't communicating to another caseworker. There were conflicting reports that weren't followed up on. And then with this 2-year-old girl who died in foster care, a doctor had said, listen, I'm concerned about this woman being a foster mother. Mm. She can't handle her own biological children. And that wasn't followed up upon by DCF. So there is, I think, the mission confusion angle to this, but there is some, I think the low-hanging fruit of just better communication throughout DCF to get things on the right track.
All right, well, let's move on and talk a bit about the news of the latest shooting rampage, this one at a community college in Roseburg, Oregon. Not exactly a local story, but it's hard to ignore anywhere in this country. And, of course, here in New England, it comes almost 3 years after the slaughter at the Sandy Hook Elementary School with the same results and many of the same questions. So just to summarize, yesterday a gunman shot dead at least 9 people, wounded 7 others before dying in the shootout with police. Officials say the 26-year-old had body armor, 3 pistols and a rifle, 5 additional magazines. Last night, a visibly angry President Obama called for tougher gun control laws.
As I said just a few months ago, and I said a few months before that, and I said each time we see one of these mass shootings, our thoughts and prayers are not enough. It's not enough.
It's not enough. So what then? This is the 15th time since Obama took office that he's had to talk about mass shootings in America. What can be done to prevent these types of shootings? Jim, is there anything new to say about these horrendous tragedies that do seem to afflict this nation in a almost routine way?
Is there anything new to say? I think the president made the point that we're all numb, and I think we are all numb at this point. We have it over and over again, and thoughts and prayers are not enough. I would say that the issue is politicized, and maybe rightly so, by both right and left, because they have strongly held views. I do think, and I've always said on this show, when we've had one of these, and this is probably the third time, there's a lot that we can do that's incremental around background checks with some arm twisting. I think even in Congress, I think there's a lot that needs to be done on mental health. And one thing I think is worth saying on mental health, which we don't say often enough, we know that mental health issues are rising in this country, but we don't often recognize the impact on men. This is an issue about men. Look, what is it, about 75-80% of the suicides in the United States are men who turn to violence against themselves when they are isolated and have mental health issues. And they turn violence on others, and they find ways to kill, whether a semi-automatic rifle, in some cases, or in this case, I think a rifle and 3 pistols. There is a lot of work we have to do for those men who are isolated, who show incident sort of features around mental health, especially in a culture where we celebrate violence, a degradation of others way too often. And final thing is when we have online access, and if you're isolated and you lock yourself into a set of communities, maybe at most, that are strong for you, that are all based on violence. It's a big problem. It's not one that's going to be solved by a law. And I think we should have respect for the limits of law and politics here, because with the hundreds of millions of guns out there, it's not going to go away through a gun law.
Shira, what do you think? Not going to go away through a gun law? This shooter I'm reading had something like a total of 13 guns in his possession, and I'm not sure if gun laws could have prevented him from getting all those guns, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think sometimes when these things happen, we say, well, would the gun law have helped in this instance? But the issue is, I think we just need to take more guns out of people's hands, in the sense that, the assault rifles, I don't understand, and this frustrates me to no end, why those are not prohibited. Why does anybody need to be carrying around an assault rifle? But beyond that, I agree with everything that Jim said. But in some ways, Jim isn't telling us anything we didn't know a month ago when the last, mass shooting happened, that we didn't know a year ago when the last mass shooting happened. And to me, I don't mean to be a cynic about this, but if nothing was done in the wake of Sandy Hook, in Newtown, when 20 children were killed, and that didn't galvanize legislators, it didn't galvanize the public more, I am not optimistic that we'll get anything pushed through legislation-wise in the near future.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading the Los Angeles Times on this story, and they reported that there was sort of radio silence from the NRA, and then earlier today, the NRA tweeted for the first time talking about this, and their tweet was, "There's a lot we can do to teach our kids about gun safety."
And there's the root of the problem.
I mean, you read that, and even trying to stay impartial in this debate, it's really, really hard to read those words and not say, really? Mm-hmm. Is this about gun safety, NRA? Or is it about or is it about just this nation being awash in dangerous guns that have a lethality that you can't overstate?
Yeah, we need better gun safety with assault rifles. That's going to solve it all.
Yeah, well,
I don't know. I feel like Jim, you said you hit the nail on the head, because I keep coming back to year after year. Maybe the truth is that we have to accept and acknowledge that this country has a high tolerance for a very violent culture, and we have to just ask ourselves, what does that mean? I mean, as you were saying, Shira, no movement after Sandy Hook. To me, I just thought,
if
what
20
more
elementary
could it
school
take?
Kids don't get
so
yeah.
So I mean, and that's on all of us. But anyway, okay, let's just try to end on a positive note here with our hubbubs. We've got just enough time for really quick hubbubs today. Jim, let's start with you.
Mine is a hubbub for a rainy fall day and a reminder of winter, and it's about Carolyn Lynch, who's well known to kids in Lawrence and all around the Commonwealth and around the country for giving access to great schools to lots and lots of kids. Buried in the article the Globe had in the fourth paragraph says this: less than 2 weeks ago, Mrs. Lynch was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and died this morning, just 2 weeks ago. That's buried in there. For listeners, as they said in Shawshank, it's time to get busy living.
Shira, your hubbub?
Well, I wanted to recognize Pete Goodwin. He sat on the copy desk at the Boston Globe, in the Boston Globe sports department, for more than 30 years. And this week he took the buyout and left the Globe. He wanted to leave quietly, but I'm not going to let him do that. I'm not going to let that happen. Because as papers across the country struggle and shrink because of buyouts and layoffs, the people who make these papers great, the people who really care very deeply about the quality of the product, should be recognized. And Pete, Pistol, as he was known on the desk, was one of those people.
Oh, well, I mean, I never knew I was looking at his work, but Pete, thank you.
Yes.
All those years.
Thank you, Pete.
Of great work. Anthony?
All right. Well, I've got to mention a sort of encore appearance. These two guys from Malden, Michael Bergen and his friend Jay Foster, who posted that video on YouTube that went viral about their encounter with a big sunfish in Boston Harbor. Yesterday, Shira, we talked to your colleague, Callum Borchers, about...
Love this story.
Yeah, about how these guys got their 15 minutes of fame, but they also are cashing in on it. They've got a t-shirts, an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live, possibility of a reality show, and just for the pleasure of hearing their sense of awestruck wonder, here they are again.
We have a wheel here, bro. Look at this thing we got here. Oh, man. Holy This is going on Fox 25 News tonight. Oh my God, Jay, look at him, he's trying to get away.
What kind of fish is it, dude?
Who the f*** knows? It's Moby Dick.
All right, thank you, Michael Bergen and his friend Jay Foster, for making us laugh a little bit.
Fox 25 and WBUR. Okay, so my hubbub is the fact that in Boston this week, an officer recently pulled over a driver for the right reason, because the driver had a really, really interesting license plate that simply said, "Peace." And the officer had been thinking about the Martin Richards statue that was unveiled last week. And he asked the driver, "Why does your license plate say peace?" And the driver just said, "Why not?"
So, good.
That's my hubbub for the day.
All right. And a good thought to go off on into the weekend with. Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Thank you, Shira. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank
good
you.
To be with you.
Stick with us. There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.